Chapter 3, Parenthood. He never missed a meeting, or was he a good dad? It's one thing to be a child. It's an entirely different thing to become a parent. Becoming a parent is one of life's major turning points. It changes our lives forever. For entrepreneur and CEO Steve Blank, this was a profound change in his life. He went from being all about his own success to being focused on somebody else.
If I can, Rick, I'll just tell you a Zen-like moment that happened to me in an organization. For, I'd say, the first 10 years of my career, I was focused on being. I was a vice president of a public company when I was 29. Man, that was a career goal. I nailed it. It was exciting. I was into being. I had that Porsche when I was just, I got it that same day I became a VP at 29. My goal, I met all those being goals. I was accumulating people, and my ego and worth was measured by my headcount. If I had more people and bigger offices than the head of sales, as a head of marketing, I was doing great. And then one day, something snapped, just snapped, just a clear break. I realized I was measuring my life and certainly my life at work by the wrong things.
Recall it all. What made that happen?
Sure.
Was there something?
Now that you ask that, I know exactly what made that happen. I had my first child. You know, if you're single, your whole life is focused around you, and rightly so. It is about you. And my first part of my career was pretty selfish. There was me, and then there was me, and then there was me, and maybe somewhere there was you, but it certainly wasn't in the top three. Even when I had girlfriends, or, you know, yeah, there was me and me, and if I have time, we'll have a date, and then there might be you. But, you know, when you're a parent, you really have to make some choices early on. And I had kids later in life where I got to watch other of my peers make choices where they still put work first after having children. And I saw the effect that that had on their kids as they grew up. And I even remember, this just was an unconscious but a conscious decision, saying, you know, work is important to me, but there's now something else in my life that's more important, which for the first time was a big idea. And so this really was an insight on how to both focus on what I cared about, which was work, but put it in context with other things that were important to me, which was family. And getting that work-life balance was something that I think made my last decade as an entrepreneur and then as a CEO really different than I think from a good number of my peers. And it's why I retired at an early age, be with my family. But the most important thing was one that somebody taught me decades ago that always was in the back of my mind, was being a great father and parent. Because on your tombstone, they said, would you rather have he never missed a meeting or he was a great dad? And I think I picked the latter.
Alex Fish. As we heard in Chapter 2, Alex Fish was an out-of-control teenager who got arrested, was homeless in Golden Gate Park, and spent time locked up in a psych ward. Yet he turned out to be an exemplary father and a successful small business owner. After his father, Robert Fish's memorial, I interviewed him and his 12-year-old daughter, Sylvia, about how he survived those early years. What Alex learned along the way is that not only did his father's unconditional love get him through the train wreck that was his childhood, but it also is a gift that he's passing on to his daughter.
Different, you know? And he's like a really good dad. And I think that actually helps him a little bit, because then, now if like I begin to do that when I'm a teenager, he knows what to do. You know, he'll know like how to help me and stuff.
Well, I would say that the ability or skills or whatever to be cool dad was certainly always there. It's just a lot of other stuff had to get out of the way. First, drugs and alcohol had to get out of the way. And then a lot of the ways that I related to the world that caused the pain, that caused the drug and alcohol use, had to get out of the way. And not that they've completely gotten out of the way. I mean, it's a life project there. Okay, so we've talked a lot about love and unconditional love. The idea that that is one of, if not the most important things between people and in life, was kind of a long time coming. And I think that that is pretty essential in how I relate with Sylvia and how I like to relate with anybody now. I think that in order to do that, there has to be a level of vulnerability, and with that comes a potential for a lot of pain. And with the potential for a lot of pain comes a lot of fear. And the fear is what, for me, set up all those roadblocks to being cool dad or cool guy or cool anything. So after I quit drugs and alcohol, one of the other tools that has helped me a lot has been meditation. I'm also helped by the fact that I work with an awesome guy that I've been friends with for 20 some odd years. And I've created and had the good fortune to have been able to create a life in which I have a lot of supportive people, which make a big difference. I mean, nobody can really do anything completely by themselves, but having Sylvia, having Kelly, having my dad Lynette, having my mom, having the other friends that I have in Portland. I mean, I'm not the kind of guy that calls up people a lot in crisis, but knowing that they're there and having the connections that I do make it all possible for sure.
For me, being a parent was a non-starter. I knew I'd be a crappy parent. Living paycheck to paycheck, I simply couldn't afford a child. Add to that more depressing news. As an only child in a pretty dysfunctional alcoholic family, I had no experience with happy families. In addition, as a psychologist, I'd worked with amazingly screwed up families. Who'd want to jump into that garbage dump? Fortunately, my wife Mary comes from a terrific family, as we heard in Chapter 2. These people actually love and respect each other. Given this new model, it slowly began to dawn on me that maybe becoming a parent wouldn't be such a bad idea after all. So later in life, after a lot of thought and consideration, we made the big decision to have a child. I was 51 when our daughter Katie was born. It was one of the best decisions I ever made. People change. I can't imagine my life without Katie. Parenthood is full of drama and crises, like when Katie got a DUI, but it's also filled with a lot of laughter and good times. When I think of Katie, I think oftentimes of her sense of humor and the fun we've had together. As an older father with rapidly graying hair, in public I often got mistaken for Katie's grandfather. At first this was charming, then it became annoying. Katie knew how this irritated me. She helped me deal with it one time at the Portland airport without skipping a beat.
My daughter and I were in Portland coming back from a trip, and we had some time to kill, and they have a Pendleton shirt store there. And so we went into the Pendleton shirt store and we were shopping around, and Katie got a thing and I got a shirt, and we're talking to this very nice lady at the counter, and she's being sweet and everything. Now, there's a little background I should tell you. I was 51 when my daughter was born, and so by the time she was in fourth or fifth grade, I had quite a bit of gray hair. And the teachers were like, "Oh, so nice, Grandpa coming in with the granddaughter." Well, it was sort of funny for a little while. And then people used to say that to me in public and stuff, and it sort of pissed me off in a way. And so this woman, this very nice woman in the Pendleton store, said, "Oh, isn't this nice, Grandpa coming shopping with the granddaughter." Folks, something clicked. I mean, something just went, I had it with this crap. And so I looked at her and I said, "Yeah, it's just, I got this really sad look." I said, "Really, it's terrible. Her father was a policeman and he got killed by a shootout in a bank robbery." And then without missing a beat, my daughter Katie, then 10 years old, says, "Yeah, my mother's a heroin addict and she's in jail and prison." And the woman, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Katie and I walk outside, high five, yeah!
Sometimes the jokes were on other people, like at the Portland airport, but sometimes they were on us. One night when Kate was in the sixth grade, she was going to the Friday night dance at the school. We dropped her off at 6, and we were to pick her up at 8. As we dropped her off, I teased her by saying, "Well, honey, maybe you'd like Mom and me to come in and be our chaperones for the dance." She was mortified at the very idea. "I don't want to see your faces around here at all." So Mary and I went shopping at Safeway, bought some groceries, and we picked up a couple of extra shopping bags. When it was time to pick her up at 8 o'clock, we cut eye holes in the bags and put them over our heads. Walking from the car to pick her up, When she saw us, she went completely nuts, which was the point of it all. And we said, well, you said you didn't want to see our faces. We still laugh about that one today. Over the years, as Katie has said and done some funny things, I wrote them down. I kept a little journal of her interesting and prescient observations about life. Here are some of my favorites. She was about 3, and we had just visited her aunt in Healdsburg. Just before getting back on the freeway to come home, we stopped by and got a McDonald's hamburger. She was in her car seat in the back and slowly drifting off, holding on to her hamburger. So Mary reached back to get the hamburger, and Katie woke up with a start, immediately complaining. Mary said, well, honey, you were drifting off. Katie said, no, Mom, I can eat and sleep at the same time. One day she said, Dad, I have to go poo-poo. So I went in the bathroom with her, and nothing happened. She offered up this explanation. My poo-poo's asleep. When she was about 4 1/2, one day she got really mad at her mother. And she said, Mommy, I hate you. And I'm still going to hate you, even when you're my grandmother. Speaking of grandmothers, when she was about 5, I was telling her that my mother, her grandmother, had died some years ago. And she said, very concerned, did your mother die before you were born? When she was 6 1/2, we took her to see a performance of Carmina Burana in San Francisco. She later said of the male dancers, why are they wearing those tights? You can see their butts. About that same time, one day I was complaining to her about my fat belly hanging over my belt. Well, Katie, I need to go on a diet and get rid of all this fat. She said, no, you don't. Just get bigger clothes. Now there's a sensible response to the diet problem. She was about 7 years old when she said, I know what sex is. What? When people get naked and kiss. I said, yes. Have you and Mom ever done that? Yes, we still do. Long pause. Can I watch? Katie was 9 years old and we were on an airplane flying to Spokane for a family reunion. She was in the middle seat, and there was a woman sitting in the window seat who was flying to Spokane because her son was having emergency surgery. The woman was looking out the window and crying. Katie was very concerned. She had just seen the musical Annie, so she got a napkin and a pencil and wrote the woman a note which said, "The sun will come out tomorrow." The woman completely lost it. She gave Katie a little flashlight with Winnie the Pooh on it. We went to an antique show in San Mateo one day. I bought her a doll for her 10th birthday using a credit card. My wife Mary was mildly disapproving of all of this, thinking it was too easy for Katie to get whatever she wanted from me. As we walked away from the doll booth, I said, I think you just love me because of my credit cards. Would you still love me if I didn't have credit cards? And Katie said, oh, sure, Dad. Then you'd just pay cash. When she was 15, the 3 of us were out to dinner. Mary and I were talking about our first marriages. Katie commented, sometimes the first marriage is a practice marriage. The conversation went on for another 4 or 5 minutes. Mary said something that made me angry. We got into a big argument. Without missing a beat, Katie said, sometimes the second marriage is a practice marriage. We all cracked up. All of this reminds me of times when I was in my mid-20s, and people used to tell me all the value of having children. There'll be somebody there to take care of you in your old age. I always thought that sounded like a bunch of garbage. What a terrible reason to have children. Now that I'm in my 80s and heavily into retirement, I realize how important that is. I love having Katie in my life. She's not only gives me that humor, but also she does errands for me. These people were right after all. It is a huge benefit to have an adult child around who can help you struggle through old age. As I've gotten older and noticed the years rolling by, I realize I don't have that much time left. So one of the things I think about is that I want my daughter to have a sense of what my life was about. What was important to me? What did I care about? What did I do for a living? That issue came up in the interview that I did with the retired dancer we met in the last chapter, Josie Garthwaite-Sedan.
My name is Josie Garthwaite Sedan. I'm mom to a toddler. I live in San Francisco, and I just recently retired from professional dancing after 10 or 15 years doing that.
Why did you quit dancing?
A lot of reasons. The biggest thing in this moment had to do with not wanting to travel and work late nights anymore. With a young child, that was just really hard. But I also, I had my child and I came back and felt like I really came back to the top of my abilities and felt like I had done what I kind of came to do with that too.
What kind of legacy would you like to leave as a dancer?
What kind of legacy do dancers have? I mean, it's the most ephemeral form. Video doesn't quite capture it. Photography doesn't quite capture it.
You certainly have a legacy with your son, you know. I mean, and so maybe not, since you're not dancing professionally anymore, I'll bet there'll be something that gets passed on.
I hope so.
Touches you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What would you like to see with him in dance?
I would never put an expectation of dance or art at all on my son.
It's hard to talk about.
Yeah. I would, for his sake, I would rather he's never drawn to it. I would hope he's never drawn to it.
Never.
It's
drawn.
It's a hard life. But I would hope that he somehow knows that it was a part of my life.
While parenthood can be stressful, expensive, and full of crises, it can also be extremely satisfying. As Jane Hunter pointed out, it can feel almost transcendent. For me, it has been a great journey from being skeptical about being a parent at all to realizing that it is one of the most important things I've ever done. The next chapter, music, is the last one of Phase 1, Childhood. I put it here because I got hooked on music as a toddler, listening to my parents' 78 records, Ella Fitzgerald, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller. Music has sustained me from that day to this.